This is Dave Crippen with another series of interviews with automotive design and automotive designers. We are at the Henry Ford Museum, the archives of the Henry Ford Museum. And this is June 28th, 1984. And today we're talking with James A. Arnold, known to his friends as Jim, who has been with the Ford Motor Company as a designer for at least 30 years, very close to 30 years. And so we'd like you, Jim, to just set your own pace and start from the beginning, from your first the first influences on you, and take it from there.
Well, let's see. I can remember way back before the 30 years began, when I was residing in Alabama, even before the time that I went into college, you know, wondering just what career I was going to get into. Probably had a pretty normal childhood. I was very interested in art and design. I always often thought I wanted to be an inventor. And went through my high school, and at that point I still hadn't decided what I wanted to do, and I never heard of the field of industrial design. And I was going through the various catalogs of the schools, and I happened to have the catalog of, at that time, the Alabama Polytechnic Institute, which is now Auburn University. And they had just set up a course in industrial design. At that time it was a four-year course. And as I read through the curriculum, I think, I said, that's exactly the kinds of things that I'm interested in doing. Up until that time, you know, I'd drawn and sketched, I'd built and flown model airplanes, I loved cars and I loved airplanes and things that were mobile and moved and but yet without any direction or anything to it. So I enrolled in industrial design, and I never deviated at all from that original idea I knew I was in the profession that I loved. I had no idea what job laid out there and where it might lead or anything, except it was designing, because it calls on your creative intuition. It enabled me to develop the tools that you need, you know, the drawing skills and the communicative skills, whatever it need be to get across these ideas that I'm inventing. So I took my 4 years and Auburn University, and then in order to pave my way through, I signed up for ROTC, which, you know, supplemented your salary, so that helped pay some of the tuition. It just so happened that little fluke there, being ROTC, is what eventually got me stationed in Michigan in the Air Force. I had to serve a two-year stint. I was served at Selfridge Air Force Base. I was a second lieutenant up there. I also loved photography, and I was the base photographic officer up there, public information officer. And up until that time, I didn't really particularly think about designing cars. I just wanted to design whatever. And I suddenly realized I was in the hub of the design industry. You know, I'd heard maybe Chicago, and I knew that cars were done in Detroit. But I'd held the car designer and the automobile industry in such high esteem that it was just beyond my wildest dream that I would ever wind up designing cars. Because in the classes down in Alabama, we were so far removed. And I had another little taste of that later in my career I'll tell you about, when I was in Australia, being far removed. You can lose track of, you know, what's really out there, and what you perceive is the reality. And I found myself sitting here, and my term was running out in the Air Force, and I had to make a decision. At that point in time, my wife was enrolled at Wayne University in education, and she had two more years to go, so I needed some kind of a job so she could finish school, and whether I wound up back down south or what. So I had a portfolio of various design items, you know, products, furniture design. I'd won a design award, national design award, in furniture design. And as I say, at that point in time, it seemed like it didn't matter as long as I was designing something. I felt that I was an industrial designer, and I needed the right breaks and the right opportunities to develop this great career that I had ahead of me. And I think it was almost just out of desperation, I decided I may as well interview an automobile company. And I interviewed General Motors first. I talked to a man by the name of Taylor, who was the personnel man at General Motors in 1950, around 55. It may have been 54, because I got out in February of 55, so that would have been 54. And Mr. Taylor looked at my portfolio, and he's a very stern man, and he said that these jobs are very hard to come by, and they don't have many openings. And as you know, Mr. Earl ran the business there.
Harley Earl,
yes. And he spoke very highly of Mr. Earl. And he didn't know, but I had been reading up on the automobile. And I had begun to think that I was becoming an authority on automobiles. And he must have been impressed to at least a degree that, you know, I did seem to know a little bit what I was talking about. But I knew of some of these characters. You know, I knew Harley Earl and his dream cars, and I really would get excited about them. And then I was theorizing about what a car should or shouldn't be. Believe it or not, in those days, I thought steam was going to be the way we would go. Eventually, we would propel cars with steam. And, you know, it just sounds bizarre now, but I had this notion that that's the way a car would be. On my second interview, he brought out Jim Sipple and Ned Nichols. And Jim Sipple and Mr. Nichols were the first two real live designers that I'd ever seen. I mean, I'd read about them, and I think they frightened me to the point I don't even know what I said or anything. But I was so pleased that they would even give me the time today to look at my portfolio. And they came out and were very polite. They went through all my sketches. They gave me some constructive comments, and which I really took to heart, because I was really gluing on every word they said. And they thanked me for coming in and considering General Motors. And, you know, no promises. They didn't say you have a job or anything, but they just gave me some very constructive criticism on my portfolio, and then excused themselves because they looked busy. I mean, their sleeves were rolled up, and you know, I'm sure they were really going. And so I kept working on my portfolio, and for some reason I took the portfolio to Ford. I took it to Chrysler, and I took it to Ford, and also I had planned to take it back to General Motors. But when I went to Chrysler, they were interested, and when I came to Ford, I talked to Roy Brown, and Roy told me that they were working on this exciting new car that was coming out. It was a top secret. You couldn't tell me anything about it, but it's going to be a revolutionary new car. And he was looking for designers, and he looked at my portfolio, and he said, "I can use this." That was his exact words. He said, "I'll recommend this to the front office." And I said, "Well, I appreciate that." And he says, "I can't guarantee salary or anything." He says, "I know it's going to be low." I said, "Well, I'm really not at this point interested in salary." I said, "I need a job desperately. I need a break." And to myself, I felt that if given the break, I would work out all right, because I had, you know, enough confidence that I thought I could make it. So they called me and told me I had a job if I wanted it, so I accepted it. Now, at that point in time, as impressed as I was with the car company and couldn't believe that I'd actually landed a job with them, I still considered it only a temporary job. And because I think I really wasn't sold that car designing was my ultimate career as a designer. I still felt that I could design anything, you know. But I think as time went on, and I even looked for other jobs. I looked for other employment in industrial design offices. You remember some of these offices that are now either gone out of business or changed names, Sundberg and Farrar. Teague, Walter Dorman Teague, you know, I interviewed all those officers, Dreyfus. But I would come out of those offices somehow feeling that they were doing a lot of, like, small projects. You know, labels and bottle stoppers and caps and here, you know, I've got an opportunity to do automobiles. And when I evaluated the two, the automobile just seemed like such a much more of a challenge design. But at the same time, I realized that my credentials weren't the strongest either, because even at that time, most of the automotive designers were coming out of Art Center School.
Yeah.
Very strong portfolios, able to render, able to just had a feel, you know, had gasoline in their blood and this kind of thing. There were some very colorful people on the scene that I admired. I don't know where they came from. You know, Alex Tremulous was one of the first gentlemen, and Dean Bordenay, Della Rosa, and of course the troops over. And at that time it was Exner at Chrysler and
Virgil Exner.
And we set these people up as kind of our ideals, you know, as people that we would want to strive for. And even Teague was around.
Who's that?
Teague.
Teague was still active.
Walter Teague. Teague over at American Motors. Dick Teague was out there bouncing around that time too. And they were all known to people, and they were getting all the write-ups in the magazines. So I think I was caught up in the glamour of the thing because, you know, I'd see the names in the magazines, you'd see pictures. Sometimes you'd see your own sketches published. You know, they just come through and rip things off the wall, and you see them. Well, that was quite an ego trip for a young designer, you know, to see one of his sketches published out there. And occasionally they would ask you to do a page for a book that they were putting together, or an insert for a styling book, or this, that, and the other. Occasionally you'd get to stand beside a car, and you may have only done a bezel for the taillight, and they'd take your photograph. So that was all enough to keep the juices going, you know, the enthusiasm. But I think I stayed with Ford about 5 or 6 years before I really made the basic decision that I was going to stay. I think up the first 5 years, I kept entertaining the idea that I was going to go south again. Because the Californians, believe it or not, even though they were all coming, they all said they hated Michigan. And that, you know, the climate will kill you. You'll never survive more than 5 years, all that kind of thing. So a lot of them were coming in and bailing out and going back. The other thing that was happening in the 50s, in the mid-50s, is that there was a great need for designers. The industry was expanding very rapidly, and there was a shortage of designers. And there were a lot of unqualified designers in there at the time on the board. I mean, I don't have to name names, but they were hiring people in there that didn't have the real design credentials. I mean, they were marquee designers, they were advertising people, fashion designers. They were just had the dragnet out and were pulling them in. And believe it or not, some of these worked out. Some of these, maybe it's like me. You know, I'd never done cars until I got into business. And I had the advantage of a degree. And you know, we had some business courses and engineering courses. And I could kind of transcend beyond the immediate assignment and see the overall thrust of what was happening. So I think that kind of helped me a little bit to have an advantage. And that process took to really weed out and get to the real hardcore designers probably took about 10 years. I'd say it took from the mid-50s to the mid-60s. With the demise of the Edsel and so forth, you know, a lot of those people left. Schools had shifted into high gear. More schools began to get prominence in automotive design. We got them out of Cleveland. Some came out of New York, Syracuse. Then the Society for Creative Studies, which at that time was Arts and Crafts.
Mm-hmm. Here in Detroit,
they set up a design school, and they were gaining credibility. So somewhere in the late 60s or maybe even early 70s, the personnel department decided to strictly seek their talent from these schools. And they also made it established a policy that there would have to be college graduates with a degree in design and in whatever, well, at least a degree in design before they would hire.
You'd gotten your degree in industrial design at Auburn.
Yes, I had a degree in industrial design, which at that time was, you know, rather a rare degree.
What were the component parts of the degree program that you felt most helped you in your later career at Auburn?
The ones that helped me to get ahead, I think, of course, the designability is the forward thrust.
Yeah, yeah.
But the creative thinking process, we had a very good professor down there, a fellow by the name of Jack Crist, who he left there, he went to Syracuse University, then he went from Syracuse University to University of Illinois, and then he went out to San Jose College, and he's still out there. And as a matter of fact, I just saw him last summer. Yeah, I was out there, and he remembered me. But he sort of spearheaded a lot of this. In order to be a designer, one must, and then he would, you've got to be familiar with what's going on in the world, not just design, but current events. You've got to be astute in business. You've got to think as a manager would think. You've got to be able to wear several hats, you know, see the financial side of it. They didn't know how to structure this course exactly then. So this course was under the School of Architecture when I was there. It was in the School of Architecture. But they went through and selected out courses in business and engineering. A lot of courses I took were in engineering, some architectural courses, and then the last 2 years was heavy in what we call the Industrial Design Lab.
Yes.
And then that we would get these practical assignments at that point. And then, believe it or not, we got a lot of literature, English and literature, in that. I never did figure out why it was so heavy in that, but when I look back, you know, that helped. Being able to write and express yourself and being knowledgeable, that's art, mm-hmm. and part of the arts. So there it is.
Did you get any courses in actual automotive design?
Not at Auburn. However, some of that was my own choosing. That was our choosing. So you could choose, you could pick from a number of projects that they would give you. And some of the guys did cars, did automobiles down there. I know when I was, I think I was a sophomore, one gentleman did as his thesis an instrument panel, an automobile instrument panel. And it was a safety panel. And we're talking now 1951. And it was one of these, it was a panel that had safety considerations where his head could go into the panel, you know, and meet the head impact requirements. Yeah. And he did all the research and, you know, as much as he could. Some of that was being done at the University of Michigan then.
That's true.
And
some of the early, the later Kaisers yeah. were coming up with that.
His concept was a crushable metal. He came up with an aluminum panel that would absorb the head impact.
That was pioneering.
Yeah. Yeah. Then another gentleman did strictly an exterior concept, and he built a model, beautiful wood model, and when I look back on it, it actually had all very sharp square edges, because at that time we thought, you know, the modern design was to have real sharp edges, but it was basically a box, but it was a nice shiny one, and he got a good grade on it. But I'm not sure if the people up here were doing much better at the time, because, you know, we do go through the cycles.
So Roy Brown has hired you then in 55,
mm-hmm.
and what was the assignment, your first assignment then at Ford?
They had a training program that lasted anywhere from 6 months to a year, and I went into an advanced, I think it was an advanced studio.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for Ken Spencer. I don't know
yes.
if that name rings a bell with you.
Yes.
And John Najar was Ken's boss.
Uh-huh.
So we would just go through an evaluation period. They called it training program, but I felt that I was being evaluated. They would give me these assignments where they would look at the way I rendered chrome and the way I rendered plastic, and look at I'd do things like wheel covers and hood ornaments and little details. But I can't, during that process, in the corner over there, in that studio, some of the more advanced trainees, so to speak, were working on a car called the Mercury Turnpike Cruiser Show Car.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that one.
Yes,
or not.
Very much.
And I was watching that happen, and it was a very exciting car to me. So one day Ken asked me to do some sketches for the Mercury Turnpike Cruiser, and he wanted something different up in the top of the A-pillar. You know, that's the front pillar that goes up to the roof.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember this, but there were these round intakes that had these spikes sticking out of them.
Oh, yeah.
Looked like antennas.
Yeah.
Well, that came off of one of my sketches.
Did it really?
He picked that right up and put it on there, and it eventually got in production. And so I, you know, to walk around and point to something like that and feel, I felt good about it, but I didn't, never had the nerve to go and tell people I did that one.
You should have.
But, so that's where it started. And then they must have thought that I was coming along all right. And I expected to be in there a year, but after 6 months they said, well, I think you're ready to go into a studio assignment. The only thing they said was that since you have an industrial design background, we feel you would probably be best suited for interiors at this point in time. It doesn't rule out exteriors, but interior. So I went into the Edsel Interior Studio.
Why was that a cliche at the time? Did you agree with it?
I guess I basically did have to, because I did feel more comfortable designing interior components at that time.
Uh-huh.
Because it was, you know, I'd come out of the strong the Bauhaus
right.
School of Design, form follows function. And I felt that these were elements that you could evaluate, you could get a hold on them, and,
yeah.
and design something that was meaningful there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I felt that the exterior was a little more abstract. It called for some kind of a feel that I needed to develop further
mm-hmm.
at that point in time. So anyway, I dug into the interior end of it. I thought that was a real challenge. I love that.
This was the then Special Products Division.
Yeah, they called it the Special
right.
Products. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Working on the E-car.
Uh-huh. And did you work with Roy on the Edsel? What later became the Edsel?
Yeah. I wrote that Edsel project right down to the bottom. Yeah. Yeah, I stayed right with Roy. And I remember these gentlemen coming in, you know, like Dick Craffey
mm-hmm.
and Emmett Judge.
Yeah.
And the planners would come in and talk about the strategy of the Edsel, and it was going to go into this intermediate range that where we had the void. And at that time, more so than now, secrecy was really stressed. And me, coming out of the service, felt when they said something was top secret, it rang a very familiar bell to me, because I was the security officer in service. So I felt that I could not even divulge any of this, even at home, you know, my relatives, I just couldn't talk about this top secret. And even that intrigue was kind of, you know, interesting to work with. And then I'd find that this secrecy was almost a myth, because we knew just about exactly what General Motors was doing, and they knew what we were doing, and you'd see the spy photographs, and then it all began to kind of vaporize. Not that I began to go out and blab a lot, but I just began to realize that it was overplayed a little bit.
Industrial espionage was a
yeah, that was quite the going.
Science.
Yeah, that's right. Industrial espionage. We had, you know, all the doors were kept locked, and you couldn't go from one studio to the next. We have much freer rein now. Around.
Were you pleased with your work on the then Edsel, the later Edsel, in terms
yes.
of interior?
Yes. As a matter of fact,
Roy, by the way, is very pleased with his work. He makes no apologies.
Oh yeah, there's.
Well, you should.
No, there. I don't think there's anything to apologize for on the Edsel. As an interior designer, they selected one of my renderings that started the 1/3, 2/3 concept on the seat. I did some crazy way out rendering that was floating, a seat that floated off of a pedestal. It had a driver's seat, and then about 3/4 of it was a bench seat with an open back, by the way.
Yeah.
And Roy jumped on that. He said, "No." That seat would never fly the way it is, but it conceptually is what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for a driver's oriented seat with a, so he called it the 1/3, 2/3 seat. And actually the final car came out, you can see they made a conscious effort, we made a conscious effort to segregate the driver from the passenger. The panel that was chosen was not my design, but I did work on the steering wheel that had the push button.
Mm-hmm. You know, you did?
Yeah.
Was that pretty much your assignment?
Oh, yeah. I still have the original rendering to that one. I kept that one in my portfolio.
Oh, dude. Yeah, that's right.
With the concentric brush rings and all that.
What were your antecedents on that? What were your inspirations?
Well, just sketch to you.
But I do recall that Chrysler had one at one point.
Oh, well, it wasn't in the wheel, though.
No,
see,
right.
The wheel had to rotate around these buttons, right. And they stayed stationary.
So where did the inspiration come to put it in the wheel, or the hub?
It just seemed like we didn't know what the word ergonomics was at that time.
Right.
It hadn't been
invented.
Yeah. It just seemed like a very logical place to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that seemed strange then, that you could think up these ideas and engineering would just go off and make it happen. There seem to be so many more constraints these days. Cost control is just tight.
Deadly.
And unfortunately, maybe I have a tendency to mentally reject things that are that far out anymore.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, I felt that
we
could reach as far as we wanted to, and somebody would give it some credibility and try to achieve it. And some of those things did.
Okay.
Now, the other thing that happened was the radio. I don't know if you remember that radio. It was a flush radio.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about safety there.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with this sketch of, had the big, large tuning dial, and then it had a concave center and a recessed center knob. It was the on-off switch and volume.
Mm-hmm.
And the result was it was completely flush to the panel.
Yeah.
It wouldn't go into your knees, you know, on impact. But
that was
only a one-shot deal. I think it was so ugly that even though it was very functional.
It's a great concept.
Yeah, it was a good concept, but it didn't fly beyond that.
I'm interested in that push-button transmission, though. That was really an innovation for the time, especially having the hub of the steering wheel.
Yeah.
Did you have any conceptual problems there at all? Did that come fairly easily?
Not that I remember. Conceptually, it just seemed to be a logical place to put it, and we started sketching it. I really, from the best I can remember, and I may be wrong, they had some, it was electrical concept, it was electrical transmission, and they had some problems with that, and I think they removed it, you know, some of the subsequent cars, they took it out.
Yeah, only in the very first few cars.
Yeah, it's only in the first ones
it
was available.
It's too bad, because it was a great concept.
Yeah, people still look back at that and say, boy, look, it's right there in the middle of the steering. Why don't they do that these days? And you wonder, why don't we? I don't know.
Exactly. Well, in terms of the Edsel, you were there until 58, so you were pretty much in on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
I was there during the time, you know, they call Black Thursday, when they, about 30% of the Edsel troops were laid off, let go. I remember coming back off a vacation. And I had been transferred, by the way, by that time to exterior. I did get my shot in exterior.
Did you?
Yeah, I think I did a wheel cover and maybe a tail light or something.
At least on the subsequent Edsel
yeah,
models. So
yeah, we were working on the new grill, the base lifted grill.
Yeah.
And then the car wasn't selling.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were some big cuts being made in the divisions. And I remember going off on vacation, and I came back, and I was in exterior studio. We had large studios in those days. I think we had like 8 designers, like just on the Pacer car line. I was in the Pacer. Then I think the Citation had equal number. And I came back off of vacation. I came in the morning, and you know, we started at 7:30 then. Well, 7:30, and there was no one there. And 8 o'clock rolled around, and no one was there. And I'm thinking, well, maybe there's a meeting going on or something that I'm missing. And finally, the supervisor came back, who was Ray Slate. And he said, I said, where is everyone? He said, well, haven't you heard? I said, well, no, I just got back off vacation. He says, they've all been laid off. The entire department had been laid off. And I was just about to say, well, what about me? And about that time, over the PA system, they announced my name to come to the front office. So that was the longest walk I ever took. I figured, well, should I gather up my papers now and first, or do it when I come back? But Roy was in there. you know, Roy said, he said, I hired you. He said, I wanted to tell you this personally. He said, we've had to let a lot of people go. And he says, you have a choice. He said, you can stay if you wish, but you'll have to go back in interiors again. And I said, I'll take it, sure. You know, because I hadn't been in exteriors too long anyway. And I'd still liked interior work, so I went back in interiors. And then eventually, I think the Edsel was merged with Lincoln Mercury. They call it
MEL.
MEL division.
Right.
And I went through. That all becomes a little foggy in my mind because we seem like we reorganized and were moved around so many times in so many studios. And I think, of course, if you look at my record, I was kind of moving pretty fast in that. You know, every few months I would move to some other group, or they'd rename the group, and then when they'd rename it, they'd bring in new supervisors and that kind of thing.
You were an MEL interior styling for a couple of years, mm-hmm. About a year and a half.
Yeah, yeah.
Back to the Edsel, if I may. The concept of the vertical design on the front, do you remember any discussions about that?
Yes, oh yes.
How did it come about?
Well, for the best I remember, I think Roy took me through this, or at least I heard a presentation.
Yeah.
He was talking to the guys, and they were putting together a big presentation, and they took a lot of the cars in the industry right then,
mm-hmm.
and they did very abstract graphic patterns of the grill and the headlamps from the front, straight front view. And they do the same thing on the rear. And I think mostly front and rear, but to a degree, the side. And they reduced them all down to little cars that were maybe 10 inches long. And they multiplied them. They had a lot of them on a board. They had maybe 20, 25 on a board. And I think they had maybe they had labels on them, or maybe they didn't. But we knew what they were. You know, they had the Buicks and the Olds and the Pontiacs, primarily because that was the competition of the Edsel. They had just about every car, there would be a competition of that car. But when you look at them in this abstract pattern, it looked like wallpaper. They were all exactly alike. And Roy said, the Edsel is going to be different when you see it. The one thing we can do, they all had a strong horizontal pattern. He says, we're going to emphasize a vertical pattern. So he took the horizontal, divided it in the middle, and put a horizontal, as you say, it was an abstract, like just a bar.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nondescript. It wasn't a design at the time. It was nothing more than just a concept.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, you know, if you were looking at wallpaper and everything's horizontal, all of a sudden you see a vertical.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there it was. And bingo, that had identity.
Mm-hmm.
Then he did the same thing. He turned the rear around. All the tail lights had a very horizontal look, you know, round ones in a row or horizontal ones in a row or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came up with this, for the better, use a better word, a banana.
Yes, yes.
The wing. It was a kind of a flying wing.
Kind of gull
wing.
Yeah, right.
And then, of course, that. Then from the side.
The scallops.
The scallops. They big emphasis at that time was body sculpturing. And Alex Tremulous invented this term called the scallopini.
Oh.
And we called those things scallopinis. And we two-toned them with these garish colors. And, you know, I mean, if they missed it the first time around, by the time we got through two-toning it, you couldn't miss it then. But it did kind of emphasize this flying wing look, you know.
Yeah.
It did look like a wing back there from the side. So
I was very impressed.
Yeah, well, Roy, by the time the theory was, now we've got a car that has real identity from the front and the rear and the side.
Mm-hmm.
He says, now there's your design, guys. You go out and make it happen. So every sketch known to man, and we did hundreds of them, they all had vertical front ends on them. I don't know of anybody that dared do a Edsel sketch that didn't have a front end on it. And just about all I remember had to. I've got a bunch of them at home. I should have brought them.
Oh, I'd love to see them.
Yeah, and because I jumped in them. I was doing them, even though I was in interiors at the time. But believe it or not, when that car was about to be introduced, you know, the marketing people picked up on that. And they said, this car has got identity from every angle. They said, why don't we shoot it from a 10-story building looking down in the parking lot? Well, that was the one aspect that we didn't have anything to identify it. If you look at it from an airplane or a building, it looked just like any other car. And Roy said, well, the only way you're going to spot that one is have it black and all the rest of them white, or the other way around. So he said, you can forget that one. You know, that, but, you know, from the ground level where most people look at cars,
sure,
we had the identity, but not from the top of them looking down.
So he scotched that one, then.
Yeah, so that was an idea. They really wanted that one badly, those marketing people, but that didn't work out.
Well, it's a very distinctive car, and it has been, you've all been vindicated today that it's become a major collector's item, a classic, really. Yes.
Yeah. It, you have one here in the village, don't you?
Yes, right.
What is it, a Pacer?
It's the big one.
Oh, the Citation.
Yeah, Citation.
Yeah.
Right. Well, was this, you obviously survived the purge.
I'm trying to think how I escaped that one. Several layoffs came around, and you know, I sweated each one of them. But I probably was because, as I said at that time, there were a lot of people out there in the industry that either didn't have the credentials, you know, to really hang in there. I had the degree, which I think went strongly in my favor. And the longer I stayed, of course, the more seniority I had. And if they used that as a criteria, oh yeah, I was so far down the line, I didn't know what criteria they used. I think the first time around, they just, Roy said if you were going to go out on a desert island and you only could take so many people with you, who would you take? So they went that way, and then whoever was left was, you know, had to, they let them go. So I think that was strictly from a performance point of view.
Well, after the demise of the ESO, which was in early 60s, mm-hmm. I mean early 60, I guess.
Right.
Then you moved on back into interiors again with Ford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a stint all in the 60s there. I did move to Ford interiors. I got to working on the Falcon instrument panel.
Oh, yes. Very utilitarian.
Yeah. Back in those days, they used to have a lot of competition between studios, even like in interior studios. If there was an instrument panel that needed to be designed, they would let the Ford studio try it, and they'd let the Mercury studio try it, and then they'd have a management review, and whichever had the best concept would be the one that was approved. That was all very stimulating, you know, because, you know, when you're still young and vigorous, you like competition. And so I was working on a concept for the Falcon panel, and the one, you know, the one that had the two round pods.
Right.
Well, that was my design.
Was it?
Yeah, I did this clay model, and it was selected, and eventually became the Falcon, and then that same cluster concept eventually fed into the Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just with the two pods and the,
mm-hmm.
on either side. But the Mustang I didn't work on that one.
Yeah, they just borrowed one of your concepts.
Yeah, it was just kind of picked up off the Falcon when they went into that design.
But the you moved around a bit, and you're now into International Advanced Studio. It sounds exciting. Was that an interesting assignment?
Oh, it was. I found that the advanced studios were not too exciting.
Oh, really?
They were exciting before I hired in the company, because the advanced studios got the show cars and all that, got a lot of publicity. But I think my real satisfaction was seeing my baby go into production. I was told that early in school that the greatest reward a designer has is seeing his brainchild coming down that production line.
Mm-hmm.
And that proved to be true, because I would get tired of sitting in advanced studios, you know, month after month, and sketching and doing renderings and dreaming and that kind of thing. I'm sure that it was beneficial to someone, but at best you had no opportunity to really make it happen. The production studios might pick up on the idea and use it to some extent, but they would discard. You felt like you lost control of the design. Mm-hmm. And you could walk around, or one could walk around and see things that were happening in the production studio that you sure that came from ideas from your advanced area, but there's no way to claim any credit for it or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I was much more comfortable getting back in the production end of it.
That same period you were working on tractors as well?
Very little tractors. Yeah, I don't remember anything. I used to get kidded about working on tractor interiors. You know,
no, today.
Yeah, but now that's not a joke anymore. No. Yeah, that's right. But in those days, I was
very plain.
That'd be the pits of design. Yeah, it was the International and Tractor. They just called it the International Tractor, but I don't think I ever worked on any tractors.
No. And you also mentioned advertising and research. Were you working in that at all?
No, I don't think I. I don't remember any advertising research.
Apparently, that was the whole.
Yeah, that package. May have just been the name of the other group I was at.
So you're in 63, and you've been promoted some years ago to Stylist A. Can you tell us a bit about the gradations of?
I came in as a Stylist B. At that time, the gradations was a Stylist B. They had a Stylist A, and then a senior, and then you'd go from senior to, I think, chief stylist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a senior in those days was really what, you know, guys like myself mm-hmm. strive to be.
Yes.
I mean, we'd give anything to become a senior designer, because a senior designer, you know, really what it said, you would become a senior.
Mm-hmm.
And when the guys would get promoted to senior designer, they felt they really suddenly had a lot of prestige and authority.
Uh-huh.
And they did have a certain amount of authority. Supervisory capacity. That's all been kind of soaked up now. I think they go by pay grades now more than anything.
By what?
More like pay grades.
Oh, uh-huh.
But there were gaps in that old system. I mean, if you would get promoted, if you got promoted from a senior, the next promotion on that was a pay grade 11. You'd go from an 8 to 11, so you'd skip three pay grades.
Mm-hmm.
So when I stayed as an A stylist for a long time. It seemed like I taxied a long time and never did get off the ground. It took me like 10 years to get up to a senior.
Mm-hmm.
And then my plane finally left the ground, and then, of course, the jumps are bigger then.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to senior and you jump to a chief designer, that was pay grade 11.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, you're off and running then.
Mm-hmm.
But I spent enough. I don't begrudge being on the board a long time. It seems like the new kids that come through now make it faster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, two or three years they're a senior, and then they zip right up.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this new classification called a 9 specialist, and they can lease cars and that kind of thing. So
they brought it down.
So they're giving out a lot of those now.
Mm-hmm.
And kids now seem, you know, they're achievers. They I don't know what it is, whether they get it in school or whether it's just the pressures of society, they think that, you know, they've got to make it fast.
Yeah. Are there more design schools today than there were when you were?
I think so.
Coming in?
I think so. Probably if you check the curriculum of a lot of colleges, I've lost track. But I'm sure that there are a lot of schools teach industrial design. I know they do out of U of M. They still teach at my old school.
Do they?
Yeah.
Get down to Auburn occasionally?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Remember the first time I ever went back to Auburn? I would go back quite often when I first went to work here, because I was anxious to tell the kids back there
sure.
that there were some opportunities up here, because, you know, remember, I'd said they're detached from reality down there. So when I would go back down there, I'd take films about car styling. I would take as much material as I could, and with the idea that I was just going to go in there and spend a couple hours and show a film, but word would get out. I mean, it'd be like a stampede around the campus. And the first thing you know, I'd find myself in an auditorium packed full of students.
Sure.
I mean, not just design students, architecture students, engineering. It was such an intriguing business.
What was going on in the real world is what.
Yeah, and boy, they would just come out, and I'd have to run those movies over and over and over, and then I'd finally just have to excuse myself because I had to leave sometimes. And one time I even left the film. I said, I'll just leave the movies here with you. Yeah. They had these self-mailers, and I just sent it back. But I think we lose track of the impact that this business has on people that are, you know, in these remote locations like that. But yes, there are a lot, I think there are a lot of schools that teach design.
That's good. And of course, a lot more industrial design in the schools,
right,
as well. Did you work much on the Thunderbird styling in the in the early 60s?
Yeah.
Which was a very interesting car.
Yeah, I was in the Ford studio and worked with Joe Orris.
Oh, yes. Tell me about your relationship with Joe. He seems to be sort of a legendary character.
Yeah, Joe was had more energy than any 10 people you'd ever hope to have. He couldn't stand still. He was patting his foot or knee-jerking or something, and incessantly talking and suggesting ideas, trying them and rejecting them constantly. And I think he probably brought into vogue the overlay, the body side, you know, with the paper overlay.
How's that work?
Well, you'd have a raw clay model sitting up there, and you'd... And I think he probably brought into vogue the overlay, the body side, you know, with the paper overlay.
How's that work?
Well, you'd have a raw clay model sitting up there, and you decide to what kind of a molding do you want on the side of it. So you'd do these long, stringy paper, you'd render these chrome pieces, and you'd go and pin them on the car, and then Joe would stand back and look at them. And then you'd take that one off, and you'd pin the next one on and so forth. You'd probably have a dozen proposals.
Oh.
And the unfortunate part about that was that we'd never make the decision. At the studio, we'd always take all those proposals to top management, so it was showbiz personified. I can remember staying in the wings when I was in it, when I was working on the T-Bird, back when Iacocca first came in. It was, I think it was the 1967 T-Bird. I think we had our egg crate grill on the front. It had a big open snout. And we had these grills about, excuse me, we had about four or five grill proposals. And we'd bring them out one at a time and hang them on the front of the car. And Iacocca would look at it and spin it around. And then he'd say, next, and we'd take that one off and bring the next one out and put it up and take the other one off. And those things were heavy. Those devils must have weighed 50 pounds each, because they're all made up out of solid metal and that kind of thing. But Joe was in his glory when he was doing that, you know. So I think he invented all those overlays. And some of it still goes on to a degree, but I think we're a little bit more professional now. We do things with a little more determination, a little more deliberate about how we do design. We do the sketching, the analyzing on paper. We know just about the kind of ornamentation that's going to enhance the car,
right,
or go with it. So, but back in those days, anything, we'd slap things on there. Honestly, anything within imagination would do it.
Using the clay model.
Right on the clay model.
Yeah, right.
You know, the idea that, you know, you go, the more ideas you go through, the more you're going to reach and try to come up with something. Unfortunately, a lot of times you get out there in production. You remember in the late 50s, like 58, you got some pretty bad body moldings on cars.
Yeah.
Remember the Oldsmobile had all those molded with like a music bars on the back.
Yeah,
of,
right.
The back staff. Fender, yeah, music staff.
Yeah. The Thunderbird of those years were rather interesting cars, though.
They, mm-hmm,
nicely designed.
Yeah, that 65, 66 Thunderbird was really a neat car. They had these rockets.
Yeah.
Shapes on the side of them.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of a takeoff of the, probably the Edsel kind of thing, you know, where you
possibly
have the scalloped,
yeah,
rear, long wing shapes on the back and that kind of thing. Yeah, it was good.
Did you get involved in many of the, back again to the 50s for a bit, did you get involved in many of the dream cars beyond the Turnpike Cruiser, do you recall?
No, I did work for Alex for a short while. They had a little studio where we would get rotated through there and work on special cars.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember too much about that, except At that time, we were working on a car called, it was a 3H model. We do a lot of 3H models. We had one called the Twister.
Oh.
And I worked on that pretty extensively. As a matter of fact, that fiberglass model is still sitting around the design center somewhere.
Is it really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a drag racer.
I wish you could retrieve it for us. We'd love to have it.
Oh, I can show it to you if you come over there sometime. Oh. It's upstairs.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yeah, I worked on a little 3/8 interior for that thing, seat.
Uh-huh.
Had a parachute, pop chute on the back and all that kind of thing.
Wow.
And I used to entertain myself by imagining all kinds of things, drawing cartoons of this car in action. Mm-hmm. You know, like the green light going off and then the chute spilling before the thing got started, you know, that kind of thing. And I'd have these little drawings around. I think it would tick off my supervisors, but it was a way of venting some of my excess energy. So I say those advanced things didn't seem to offer that much challenge.
Right. Who'd you work for in advance? Do you remember that?
My immediate supervisor, international in advance, let me see. I think my memory's not. I think I worked for Dick Steiger.
Mm.
He eventually went over to Chrysler.
Uh-huh.
He was my immediate supervisor. I don't remember who the exec was. I think Della Rosa. I worked for Tremulous once in special development.
Yes.
That was sort of an advanced group. And then Della Rosa was his boss.
Yeah.
And then Della Rosa, that's when Alex left the company. I worked for Alex when he left the company.
Oh.
And
why did he do
it? I think he got a conflict, personality conflict with Mr. McGuire, you know, Bob McGuire, the late Bob McGuire.
Yes.
And Della Rosa, and he had somehow crossed them, and maybe Bourdain, for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, I was just a small chip on the log then. But he was a very gracious man. You know, he left, and then we just continued to read about him in the papers. And I still can pick up magazines, and there's even last night. Did you? I was reading the latest automotive news.
No, I missed that.
They had a reunion of the
Tucker,
the press
yes,
Tucker.
Yes, right.
And Alex, you know, was the designer of the Tucker.
Right.
And most of the article was quoting him,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking about what a great car this thing was. Mm-hmm. And Alex used to sit back and talk about the Tucker.
Did he?
And, yeah. This, it was done in by the, was it the Trade Commission? What do you call that?
Federal
Trade Commission.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, the
and the Securities and Exchange.
Securities and Exchange
right.
Commission.
Yeah.
They accuse him of fraud and that kind of thing.
No,
but he says
vendetta. Yeah.
He told us about the time that they got these 30 or 40 Tuckers and they drove them all to Washington and parked them outside the Security and Exchange Commission because they had claimed they didn't exist. It was just a myth. There were only 10 of them or something. They got every Tucker they could get and drove across country. I've forgotten where it was, Indiana, someplace, drove all the way to Washington. Parked them right outside the window and tried to get, I've forgotten who it was, they tried to get to turn around and look out the window, and he refused to do it.
Wilson Wyatt, was it?
I don't remember who it was.
That's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
Well, you're in the mid-60s, then you finally made senior stylist, and things must be looking good.
Oh, yeah, things were picking
good.
Up. Things were picking up then. I worked for Joe then.
Joe Arras.
Joe Arras really put me through the hoop. I didn't think I was going to make it under Joe. I didn't even think I would survive, just survive, period.
Yes.
You know, I thought I'd probably get canned.
18 hours a day.
Overtime and all that kind of thing. And one day I was standing there, and I decided that regardless what Joe said, I was just going to just keep doing my best job.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd somehow made it 10 years and gotten through some pretty rough times, you know, with Edsel and everything.
Yes.
But I was then in the great Ford studio. That was the top prestige studio.
Yes.
And I really felt honored to be asked to work in there. And I worked in there I went into work in the Fairlane studio, and then I was later moved to Thunderbird. And I really didn't think I was doing too great in there. And so I just kept whacking away, and one day I was standing, he was looking at me with this kind of a strange twinkle in his eye, as though, who is this guy? You know, he seems to be doing pretty good, but I'm not quite sure I know him yet or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like my career changed after that day. He must have either suddenly noticed me or something. But it wasn't too long after that I got promoted.
That's good.
And then I tried to really step up to the new responsibilities. And then I got the second promotion. So I can look back and say Joe really gave me my two big ones.
He gave me promotion?
The chief designer.
Oh, okay. Oh,
so
yeah.
He gave me both of those.
Yeah, right.
All within about a year.
The senior designer?
Yeah, yeah. From senior, then about maybe a year, year and a half later.
Right. Yeah. What was the styling group B that's mentioned?
Styling Group B. I think that was the
Vehicle Styling Group B.
Yeah, I think that was the that was right after I made chief.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that was my first assignment.
First assignment
after
yeah.
Joe promoted me, I was transferred in. I worked for Don De La Rosa.
Uh-huh.
And it was special development or special projects. I don't remember what they called it. Maybe special development.
Mm-hmm.
And they were working on, they would work on like future, it was kind of like an advanced studio again.
Mm-hmm.
They would work on, I remember the first cars, I was working on a Mustang, like the next Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
The 65 Mustang was out, I think I was working on the 67 or 68 model. Because
mm-hmm.
I remember the first clay model ever having supervised, you know, it, with my new management position was a new Mustang. And we did it, working for De La Rosa. And we showed it to Bordney and we showed it to the planters and I don't think it got very far because Joe was still in control, you know, of the Mustang in the Ford studio.
What would happen to those sketches? Would they be?
Oh, they were clay model sketches.
Oh, I'm sorry, clay models.
Yeah, we did like full clay models.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah, and we would take them all out in the courtyard. Back in those days when, as I say, the competition was heavy.
Yeah.
So we would be competing with the Ford studio, and
mm-hmm.
there may be 5, 6, 7, 8 models out there when we get time to pick a theme. We don't have that luxury today.
No, this is bad.
No, we roll out there with 1 or 2 at best.
So you've had some input as a head stylist in the Falcon, Fairlane, and Mustang styling of
mm-hmm.
the mid to late 60s,
mm-hmm.
pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably working on about the 60-69 Mustang,
apparently. Right.
They were a good workmanlike series of cars, I recall. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very handsome and very durable. And above all, economical.
It's true.
So, you go from the Styling Group B to Design Group A. What did that entail in the late 60s?
Now that I don't remember. I think it couldn't have been much more than moving across the room to a new supervisor.
I see.
I think that Special Projects had 2 studios.
2 segments.
And they were like from one side to the other. So I may have moved from one side to the other.
Do you remember what projects you worked on in that era?
Not really, except
67, 69.
I remember they were larger cars. They may have been something like the Fairlane.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're Fairlane type cars. Because I think after that I got transferred back into the Ford studio again.
Still in interiors, honestly.
No, it's all exterior.
All exterior. Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And are you enjoying exteriors at this point?
Yeah, when I worked for Joe in there, that was still all exterior.
Oh, it was? Oh.
Oh, yeah, it was all exterior.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was into it by then. I was beginning to think I knew how to do exteriors.
Uh-huh.
You know, with having working on the Thunderbird and the Fairlane car lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I felt I could handle exteriors pretty well.
Are any one of these product groups pretty much your personal design?
Well, a little bit later, in one of these groups, I think it was after I left the Ford studio. Was that one of the A or B groups? We worked on the 72 Mark IV.
Mm-hmm.
That was when Bunky Newson was here.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I worked for De La Rosa then. And I really felt I've had more input into that car as a total car, exterior wise, than most cars I worked on.
Uh-huh.
Mainly because it was done out of the limelight. It was done in a studio that was very out of the way. We were able to do it pretty much as we pleased. There was a young man by the name of Dean Beck, he's still there, and Dave Hackett, who was a modeler, was a designer then. We basically did the total car.
Uh-huh.
and were left alone, you know, with not a lot of input or interference. And then there was another mark that was being looked at down the way that was the prime candidate, and Bunky Knutson came in and happened to see ours down there and said, well, I like that one. It was just a fluke like that. Mm-hmm. And we were told afterwards that our car was supposed to have been covered up and not even shown. But it went virtually unchanged.
Really? Now, which one was this?
The 72 Mark IV. So I still have the photographs of that clay model. It virtually went unchanged right into production. That was probably one of the earliest approvals. It was like from the initial concept to approval, and it was just locked up. And so then when, of course, after it was approved, then our management in the design center decided to, they better concentrate on that and get it fixed, you know, because we'd been out there running kind of rampant and uncontrolled on this car. Mm-hmm. So they started making suggestions about the wheel openings and about the rear end, the shape on the deck, and how it should be round instead of this flattened off sunset and this kind of shape.
Right.
And Bunky came in and didn't like it. He said, what have you done to this car? You better put it back the way it was. Well, fortunately, we left one side of it alone. So after a while, they just, hands off, we just left it exactly like it was. And that's the way it went. So I guess if I look back at something that I had, you know, more total control of, that would have been it. That would have been it right there.
Right. You've done some work on the Maverick in the early 70s also. That was a very popular car.
Now I was back in interiors then again.
You're back in interiors?
Yep, I'm back in interiors again. Uh-huh. Actually, just to put it in proper perspective, I've been here 29 years going on 30. I've almost had an equal split between interior and exterior assignments.
That sounds like an ideal situation.
And it's not like 15 years of each. It's
right.
Like 2 or 3 years here and 2 or 3 back and
That's
two or
good.
Three. So it's really been a good balanced assignment, you know.
As you were coming up, who was the premier interior stylist in those days on the company side? Someone you might have found a role model.
Mm-hmm. I can think of a man, person, but his name slips me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I had a role model per se.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall who it was. We have a lot of good interior designers, but I don't think of, you know, I know Dave Ash,
yes,
for example,
Dave.
He was Mr. Interior.
Yes, I've heard a lot of
And, you know, John Middlestead was a strong interior. He was the exec, and Dave Ash was the director.
Uh-huh.
And they were good interior people. You know, they had a good feel for it and attention to detail, and they had notions about where things should be and what they should look like. And Dave used to always say, now, you can do this panel, but there's one thing you better make sure of. He says that speedometer's got to be exactly in the center of the steering wheel, above the steering wheel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's the most important thing you got in the interior.
Right.
So.
You left it there.
So I just, you know, when I worked for him, I remember I'd always try to make sure the speedometer's right there. Then he had very strong feelings about, or ideas about fabrics, and he was a good man. He was a good interior man.
Yeah. When did he leave, by the way?
He left while I was in Australia. I went to Australia in 76. Became chief designer down there to work on the XD Falcons, and then he retired. As a matter of fact, when he retired, it created the opening the promotion that I came back. I didn't take his job, but with the director leaving, it created some openings.
Right.
And then I came back as an exec in interiors.
You're back for a couple of years, back with International Special Vehicles as design manager. How did that work out? This is in the mid-60s, 74 to 76, about a year and a half.
Let's see, International Special Vehicles. I think we were working on some of the show cars.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, in the mid-60s, yeah?
No, mid-70s, I'm sorry.
Oh, mid-70s,
yeah.
International spin. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that was a relatively short stint.
It was.
That was an assignment that I did not like.
Mm.
Because not only did we do some international cars, you know, be like grills and things like that for cars. Did some world car concepts. But the assignment I didn't like, that we were doing all the family cars, the custom family cars for Ford, you know, Mr. Ford, Mrs. Ford, and William Clay and Benson Jr. and so forth. And I just felt that, you know, working on those cars, it wasn't like they were going in production. Like I say, when I got off into advanced assignments or special assignments, I just didn't feel, I just didn't like those assignments as well as I did the nitty-gritty production end of it. So I spent a couple of years there. It seemed like we were, you know, doing special interiors, and and the color would have to be the color because, not because we liked it, but because somebody in the family liked it, and so therefore we'd do it that way. And we'd put special little innovations in them here and there that it was, you know, it took a certain amount of ingenuity to get them in there. But
so personal commissions, really?
Yeah, they were personal commissions. And the thing that was frightening me is, you know, they're very powerful people, and you'd be like, one name, your name might be mentioned at their dinner table if their car wasn't ready. You know, we'd have to adhere to these deadlines. That car, they wanted ready. Like, I remember one time Mr. Iacocca wanted to give Kathy, his daughter, a Longchamp for her birthday.
Which was a...
DiTomaso Longchamp. And I think Mr. DiTomaso had given him that car as a gift. It had like a 5-speed transmission or something, but when he gave it to his daughter, he wanted an automatic put in it. Now, I don't know if you can imagine. We had to get that thing changed over to an automatic, and, you know, the console and all that revised, new paint job. And with her birthday coming up, there was a deadline there that had to be met. And, you know, we sweated those things. You know, those kinds of deadlines and then corporate timing are, I don't know, they're two different things.
Yeah, they never seem to go together.
No, they one was really far-fetched from the other.
What about Iacocca? Was he an influence on you in terms of his sense of product, his conceptual view of what he really wanted, what the public would like?
Yeah, I think when Iacocca came, we began to feel real direction in the company. I could say that much for him. We would go into our reviews, and he was very strong in his viewpoints, and he was very vocal and direct, and I always had a lot of respect for him. I felt that he was a strong product man. We like to have the product people in control up there, and I think he still is a good product man. So that was all very good.
So
I felt the same way about Bunky.
Oh, yes. Tell me about your relationship with...
Well, I didn't have much of a relationship with any of these guys.
Your feelings about him, yeah.
But I felt Bunky was about the best.
Uh-huh.
I felt... Uh-huh. Maybe I felt the way because he's got to pick that Mark IV that I was working on. I'm not sure, but I felt Bunky had he was a real automobile man.
Well, you're not alone. Now, yeah. Others would feel the same way.
And he put some products out there that really... helped our company a lot, and the influence of those cars stayed around for a number of years. You know, these pointy-nosed Thunderbirds and things out there.
And did he not borrow a bit of the Edsel front end for one of his Pontiacs, as I recall?
Yeah, I think.
The vertical.
They may have done a better job with it. I don't know.
I'm not so sure. Remember, the vertical theme was there.
Yeah, they did.
What about Shinoda? Was he, did you come in contact with him at all?
Yeah, Shinoda had his own studio there when Bunky was there.
Uh-huh.
And Shinoda was doing a lot of special cars. You know, he was in heavy into the racing end, and he would do these, he was into the, what's that track down in Alabama? I should know.
Talladega.
I'm from that state.
Right.
I could hear. Yeah, Talladega. He was doing these cars. And
was he?
Yeah, so Shinoda had a, you know, real gasoline.
Was he doing those Talladega specials? Those?
Yeah, he was doing some of those. Yeah, he was doing some of those cars.
Those Dan Gurney things?
Yeah. So he was sealed off in like a wall by himself. I didn't see too much.
Mm-hmm.
He kept his area pretty secret.
Yeah.
Then in addition to that, he would do some cars in competition with the production studios.
Somewhat controversial, from what I've heard.
Yeah, he was a controversial person.
Yeah.
He's still around out there, though. Somebody was talking about him yesterday.
Got his own studio somewhere?
I don't know the outfit they were talking about. He's promoting a vehicle now, a three-wheel vehicle somewhere.
Alex Tremulous is still working on the job.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, Alex Tremulous is still there. Yeah, Alex is going to come up someday and set a world record. So I think he always wants to set some kind of record.
With the three-wheel
land speed, some kind of land speed record.
Well, he still thinks the gyroscope is the way to go.
Yep. Yeah.
And the three-wheel. In fact, he had a very interesting concept. He showed me a two-wheel truck, one wheel at each end.
Yeah, he had that down pat. He had those gyros. He built models that he could run across the studio floor, and they would stand there, just hover.
Do you remember seeing the early gyron?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Incredible.
He could run it. He could run it off of compressed air or whatever it took the gyro to run.
I think it was.
Yeah, Alex was quite a colorful person.
Interesting that there have been a lot of mavericks in Ford's design history, but they've not really survived, have they?
No, I guess you're
right.
I mean the
visionaries who couldn't come up with a product that would sell. Yeah. Has that been pretty much the pattern? Alex, maybe, and one or two others?
I don't think that. I don't think it's the design that gets. It's their eccentricity.
Yeah. Okay.
They're not compatible
with the
corporate. You know, they're free agents.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And Alex just didn't conform. You know, Alex was Alex. And you know, you contrast him with a guy like Bob McGuire.
Yeah.
Who also was an Air Force officer or an Army officer, you know, like where I came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, there was this, whatever you call this, protocol that he would follow to the T. And and Alex was still Alex, you know what I mean? But he was a designer first.
Uh-huh. That's good.
That seems to be the ingredient, though, that makes these guys success. That's the one thing I feel good about the profession. When the good designers survive. They may not survive in Ford Motor Company. They may not, but the good designers seem to be out there and making a name for themselves, and they got the products on the road, and they got things happening, you know, with their label on them.
Yeah.
And some good designers have taken a lot of knocks. You know, one guy that I knew down in Australia is Herb Grass. He designed the Bricklin automobile.
Oh, really?
You know, he was chief designer. You know, of course, you know, the Bricklin went down, and I hired him down in Australia.
Uh-huh.
But he's still down there, and he's doing a beautiful job. But
I'd like to talk to you about that, which apparently was a very interesting segment of your career when you were assigned to Australia. How did that come about?
I'm not quite sure. I got his phone call one day from personnel, and they said that one of the chief designers' assignment, you know, the Americans would go down on 3-year assignments.
Yes.
And at that time, I was a manager. I was working on the Fox, the
yes.
Fairmont.
Yes, the Fox platform.
Yeah, the Fox. I was working on the Fairmont cars.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that this assignment was going to open up in the summer. This was about March.
Mm-hmm.
And just asked me, would I be interested in going to Australia? And I didn't think I would be interested, but I told him I'd think it over and get back with him. So I went home to talk it over with my wife, and to my amazement, she said, well, if we're ever going to go, now's the perfect time to go. You know, the kids are old enough and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Any other time wouldn't have been the right time.
Yeah.
So then I called back and I said, I think I would be interested. I'd like to be considered. He says, well, you're not the only candidate. There were other candidates, and they were just getting a name of people who might be interested. So as time went on and they interviews got more frequent, and
mm-hmm.
they started asking more intensive questions, I began to realize they were serious about it. And I think along about May or June, they told me I'd be going down there working on the XD Falcon. You know, the one that is still out there now. As a matter of fact, it has a good record.
Gosh, that's been going for years.
That car is selling good. In fact, it's outsold General Motors down there now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good car. The XC Falcon was done back here. I remember the Australian group came back here when I was over in one of the special project studios.
Mm-hmm.
They brought the crew up here because they didn't have the equipment to do it in Australia.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's really a shirt sleeves
uh-huh.
organization down
yeah.
there. They didn't have the styling building or anything, so they came up here and did it. And the XC stayed out there for, it really grew old. It came out about 1969, and I think 79 was the one I worked on.
Mm-hmm.
I went down in 76, and
right.
It didn't come out till 79.
Uh-huh.
So that car was growing old.
Yeah.
And it was a good seller, though. But we had to hit them with an all-new, you know, modern, they wanted a very European look
mm-hmm.
to the car.
Yeah.
You know, Trevor Creed, have you heard of
him?
Trevor
yes.
Creed had
mm-hmm.
had come down there to Australia and basically done a concept that looked a lot like the European Granada. And when I went down there, that concept was pretty well accepted, but it wasn't approved yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we brought that concept home. Then we had to do, they had a Falcon, a Fairmont, a Fairlane and a Ute and a van.
Yes, yes.
And,
utility
yeah, and a station wagon. It all had to be done in a very short period of time. So once I accepted the job, and then they told me, well, the work had to be done, and I wasn't so sure. So I don't remember much about the first 6 months I was there, except I was at work all the time.
Just
I mean,
a blur
it was,
of activity.
Yeah, that's the one thing, the sad thing I look back on this. You put a lot of hours in this
mm-hmm.
business. It's interesting work, and the hours go by fast.
Mm-hmm.
But we got them all approved,
mm-hmm.
you know, on schedule. And they all got out, and the cars have been very successful. I went down for a 3-year tour of duty, and I was down there a year and a half when Mr. Ash retired back here.
Ah.
And then...
Who was the interior, Mr. Interior?
He was Mr. Interior.
Yes.
And this opening became available back here. It was a promotion. And so Mr. Bourdonnais said he had this job back here if I wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
So, see, when you go overseas, there are no guarantees that that you have a place when you come back,
yeah.
especially with a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're lucky if you come back and in the same position. I mean, not lucky, but I mean that's
yeah.
that's about as much as you can assume.
Same slot. Yeah.
Same slot.
Yeah.
So I decided to come on back and take it. It cut my...
Your tenure short.
My tenure short.
Yeah.
So I'd like to get that other year and a half sometime.
Would you like
Because I thoroughly enjoyed it.
You really enjoyed it. You enjoyed the people?
I like the people down there. The people really love Americans.
Uh-huh.
And I think it goes back to World War II, you know.
Yes.
Many Australians told me that the Americans saved them from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's nice to go somewhere and just have people appreciate you for that.
But the only country that is grateful for
yeah, they really do. They like Americans.
That's great, yeah.
And although they have many European customs, but they like Americans.
Uh-huh.
But the one thing I found, though, they've also got a brand new design center down there that was built, you know, a few years before I got there.
Uh-huh.
And it's so remote in Australia, you can't believe. It is the other side of the world. It's 13,000 miles from here. And they're so isolated down there that the only contact they have with the outside world, you know, is to read the magazines and, you know, try to sell out set telexes or get a trip over and see what's happening over here and go back. But what I found is there's something about when you find a pocket of designers like that, the designers seem to somehow be right up to date.
Really?
I don't know how they do it. But I felt that I could put that design group against anybody down
uh-huh.
there. I mean, it wasn't like they were out of it at all.
Uh-huh.
So there's something that gets instilled in a designer somewhere in it. I don't know if it's in his being before he gets trained or after he gets to school or what, but they get out there and keep up with the cutting edge of whatever's the trend.
I guess it's the nature of the work, is it not?
It
you're,
may be.
You're in the vanguard of what you're
supposed to be
doing.
Yeah,
you're
yeah that's right.
Work that's 3 years hence or 2 years hence, and I think probably you're right. You just do keep up to date. You
yeah.
have to.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. You could pull those guys out of Australia and plug them in here, and they would just keep running on stroking. It wouldn't be any.
Where is that design center?
It's in Broadmeadow.
Broadmeadow.
Broadmeadow. It's yeah. about 20 miles straight north. Melbourne, right up,
uh-huh.
right up. I forget what that highway
one
is.
Those, one of those peninsulas.
No, it's kind of inland.
Oh, inland. No. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I drove like 20 miles a day getting up there.
Did you?
But it was, really out in the flats. I mean, I could get in the car, And if I drove north instead of, if I drove south, I'd start getting back into the city. But if I drove north, I don't know if you've ever been to Australia, but
no.
If you make a left turn, you can find yourself in the outback, and you can really get into some wild country in there.
Ford has been in Australia for many years.
Mm-hmm.
The original, one of the original plants were down there. The Geelong plant.
Yeah, the Geelong plant Geelong is about plant. 50 miles. It was 50 miles from the Design Research Center there.
Was it? Still going, huh? Yeah.
But people would commute back and forth like it was across the street.
Really?
Yeah, they're getting those Falcons, and they'd drive across country about 100 miles an hour, and all that cloud of dust coming up behind them. They'd go in dry river beds, and one guy would pedal to work.
Really?
On a bicycle. And one guy named Don Thompson down there. He was one of these bicycle freaks.
Uh-huh.
He pedaled, imagine pedaling to work 50 miles and pedal. But he did, I don't know how long he did that. He was doing it when I was down there.
Uh-huh. The General Motors, what's the name of the General Motors car down there?
Well, the one that's competing against the Falcon now is the, I see, the General Motors plant was at Fisherman Bend, they call it Fisherman's Bend. It's right on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, they're marketing the Opel Commodore version.
Mm-hmm.
They brought the Opel Commodore in when we came out with the Falcon. That was their competition.
Right.
And as it's worked out, we've really outselling them like 2-1.
Right, yes.
Let's see, what was the General Motors car called? Just slipped my mind, it'll hit me in a minute.
Mine too, yeah.
It'll come back in a minute.
Did Bill Boyer come down there after you left?
No, I replaced Bill
you
Boyer.
You replaced Bill
yeah.
Boyer?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was his, how did his relationship work out?
I think while Bill Boyer was down there, they were mainly facelifting the XC Falcon. They had the Escort they brought in from Europe. They facelifted that one.
Yeah.
And I don't think he was in any heavy programs. He had started into the Blackwood program, which is the XD Falcon.
Right.
And he had brought it up to the point of this concept, the one I described that he preferred.
Right.
And then I went down and finished that one up and did the other spin-offs of the car.
Yeah.
Then we also had to do an LTD. The LTD in Australia is like the top of the line car.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like a complete customized interior,
mm-hmm.
and it's the one that the Prime Minister drives, and it's quite a prestige car down there.
The Japanese influence the Japanese connection has really become paramount in terms of cooperation and the sharing of bodies and sharing of styling. Mm-hmm. Has that worked out in your...
From what I hear, it has. That all happened after I left.
After you left, yeah.
Yeah, they began to work with the Japanese up there, bringing this laser.
Yeah.
And the styling troops would go up to Japan and get out to the Philippines, and they began to travel quite a bit after I left.
Mm-hmm.
When I was down there, the intensified effort was just, on the Falcon.
Yeah.
And I may have gotten in on, if I'd stayed the other year and a half,
I
would have probably been jumping up and down and up into Japan working on that project. But I missed out on that one.
On the whole, the Australian experience was a good one for you.
Yeah, it was. I liked it because even though it was a year and a half stint, it was like a concentrated time working on that one car line.
Yeah.
And, like total involvement in that. And then.
Yeah.
We just about got it finished, and then I was out.
Uh-huh.
At the time, I felt like the only thing I felt I got shortchanged on was I'd worked so much overtime that I wanted to see more of the country. I wanted to travel more and see more while I was down there.
Your wife enjoyed it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And my children were down. My two kids down there.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And they stayed down.
Good. Well, you've been given this incredible, what looks to be a marvelous opportunity and promotion into luxury interiors. How did it come about?
You're my latest one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're the one after you left Australia. But you came back from Australia before.
Yeah. Well. I think that just happened to be the opening. It was there.
Uh-huh.
And probably when they
That's looked, right, Dave Asher had retired, yeah.
Yeah, when they, probably when they looked at the scope of people with the kind of experience they wanted. As I say, most of, about half of my experience was in interiors.
Right.
And I'd logged in quite a number of years under Dave Ash.
Right.
So he knew, you know, he knew me. I don't know whether he put in a word for me before he left or what.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Bourdain knew who was,
sure,
who was who around there, too.
Very savvy guy.
Yeah, Bourdain was the guy that told me. He says, Jim, he says, I've got this promotion for you if you want it. And so that came back. But at that point in time, interiors was like divided up. We really haven't got interiors really sorted out until I think maybe the last couple of years, as far as the organization. Interiors, back when I first hired in, interiors, you'd have like an interior studio next to an exterior studio. You know, in a lot of ways that's good, because you know you could see what the other was doing. But it was sort of, I think the competition or the continuity throughout the company wasn't there, because it was like, you know, one group didn't know what the other was doing, and you'd get this diversity of thinking, and the competitiveness. You know, a lot of fabric can be commonized through the cars, and a lot of your instrumentation can be commonized. I mean, it can look different. The customer never knows it.
Right.
But I'm sure it was a wasteful setup just to have all these different organizations with their own interior groups, you know, kind of doing the same kinds of things.
Right.
When I first came back from Australia, it was in two halves. There was the small car group, and then there was, I think there was a small and mid-sized group, and then there was a luxury group. And there were two execs. I was one of the execs, and Ken Nelson was the other exec. And then I kept, you know, that job was fine, but really in reality it was only less than half the responsibility that I now have. I have the same title and everything, but I have like all of the interiors now. They later consolidated under one director, all of the interiors. It was under one director then, but they had two execs. And so now it's one director and one exec, and then some multiple car line managers.
You find that?
I think it works a little
works
bit.
Luck.
Has a little bit more
continuity.
Yeah, that way.
But you've come back from Australia, and you've been given this new assignment. Did it seem to be exciting? The prospects of getting back into interiors and having design exec status.
Yeah, I was getting to the age in life then to where I was thinking, well, I suppose I should decide which I like best.
Mm-hmm.
I just, before that, I took them as they came.
Right.
And the nice part about Australia was that it was both. As chief designer, I had total car line responsibility.
Okay.
So I could keep one foot on one side of the line, one on the other.
Mm-hmm.
If I got tired of doing exteriors, I could walk down to the other end and add an interior studio.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was nice. I mean, that's probably the ideal for the designer.
Mm-hmm.
You got the total car.
Right.
But when I came back again, the choice again had to be made. And so I was beginning to ask myself, which do I like best? So I stayed there about a year in doing the small car and mid-sized car interiors.
Right.
Then, believe it or not, I was transferred to exterior again.
Yes, I see that.
Yeah, I went into exterior.
Yeah.
And that was a very exciting stint there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that was from about 79?
About 8 months. Yeah, 79 to 80.
Well, I think
then, of course, you move into luxury car. Full size.
Yeah, but that was still exterior.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
I went into Thunderbird.
Yeah, you're all the way from 79 to 81.
Yeah, into exterior.
Right.
Well, during that period was the period of time that the now current T-Bird, Mustang, and Mark were all done.
I'd love to hear about that.
And they were all, you know, I was in there at the time then as the exec.
Mm-hmm.
And the last part of that assignment, in the luxury car end of it, they took the interior group and put it under the same director. So I was exec over interior and exterior,
right,
again, over the luxury car. This is like the Mark, of the Mark IV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I mean the Mark VII, excuse me,
yeah,
so the Mark VII ones out there now. So that was really a good assignment. As far as specifics of what happened there?
Yes.
For example, the Mark VII, that's out there now.
Right.
We originally did it as a Mark 7. We did the fiberglass, we did the clay model and the fiberglass. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, I'd already moved into the luxury car. And the Thunderbird people were doing an 83 Thunderbird mm-hmm. next door. And the approved theme turned out to be a variation of the Probe. I don't know if you ever heard this before.
Yes, yes, right.
They approved it as this Probe card made a big hit over in Germany.
Yes.
So they approved the theme as a Probe. And then when they handed that that came from the staff design group.
Uh-huh.
And when they handed that over to the production studio, they said, make it feasible.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's a big step. It sounds easy, but it's a big step.
Uh-huh.
So the production studio proceeded then to try to make that car still maintain all the ingredients or the essence of the Probe appearance, but it had to be a feasible car. You had to meet all the wheel jounce requirements. I don't know if you know what the probe had, all these very flush,
yes,
covered wheels and all this kind of
yes.
thing. Just a very tight. Well, by the time it got through being engineered and with all the jounce clearances and glass angles and glass runs and heaven knows what all, that car eroded.
Mm.
And keep in mind, it was supposed to be out a year ahead of the mark.
That's right.
And so they put that car out for a survey. Meanwhile, I had the mark, had a fiberglass model of the mark sitting in the studio the way it is today.
Mm-hmm.
Had the tire on the back and, mm-hmm. The yes. aerodynamic look.
Right.
But it was a concept only. It was not approved at that time. Well, this market research was supposed to happen over the weekend. I think it was a Friday through a Monday. And they were busing these people in. It cost a lot of money to bring these people from all over.
Yeah.
Well, by the time they brought the first bus load in, they realized that the thing had died. So they looked at these things and went, gee, we still got Saturday and Sunday and Monday. And they'd gotten such bad comments on the car that they knew no way it was going to be a good survey.
Which one was this?
This was the Probe.
Probe, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
The original Probe.
So by late Friday night, they were saying, well, we got to show these people something else other than this car. So they borrowed this mark and put it in a Thunderbird survey.
Uh-huh.
But they said, we can't stick it out there because it's got a mark front end on it and a spare tire, this
right,
spare
sure.
tire on the back, and mm-hmm. people are going to know. So they said, we'll just put it off in the corner and we'll put these blackboards around it so people can just look over at it. They can't walk around, they just look over at it. And they say, well, how do you like that car versus the Probe? Well, it was an instant.